Well met, friends. I'm Steph Midlock.
And I'm Jude Bates.
Welcome to Atherbeth, a podcast exploring the Numenorean nonsense of Tolkien's Legendarium.
A bit of housekeeping before we get into this week's episode. Last week, in our very first episode, I made a mistake already. Glad it only took one episode for that. when talking about Eluthingol's death, I ascribed that to the Second Age. That was incorrect. He died in the First Age. So that was great. I'm glad that it only took one episode to need to start issuing corrections.
I am shocked to my core.
Yeah.
But you know what? I accept your apology and we're going to get over it.
Great.
Well, this week, we're going to talk about Appendix A from The Lord of the Rings and how it's a bridge between the Lord of the Rings trilogy and the Silmarillion.
I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I think it's a great topic, and I'm looking forward to getting into it.
Me too. And we've got many paths to tread, so get your Numenorean rowing arms all limbered up, and let's begin.
So, Lord of the Rings Appendix A. If you haven't read Lord of the Rings, and you're accidentally turned on this podcast.
If you got lost looking for something else.
Appendix A comes at the end of Return of the King and is a shockingly, shockingly in-depth crash course through the history of Numenor, all the way going back to the First Age,
oof,
up through the entire history of the War for the Silmarils and the War of Wrath and the whole history of Aragorn's line, basically, all the way through Numenor, the fall of Numenor, Second Age. It's a spectacular amount of history compressed into like 20 pages, something like that.
They're dense. They are like a gluten-free bread. It's just going to be a rock of information.
Yeah, it's a ton of information. It's a really interesting piece because, and this is sort of how I want to approach this, is It's a bridge between the Silmarillion and the Lord of the Rings. One of the things that makes the Lord of the Rings really powerful is this impression of depth, right?
Right.
You feel like there's this enormous amount of history and story and world out beyond the edge of the page in Lord of the Rings.
Absolutely.
A lot of scholarly work has been done in showing how that works. And we'll talk about that in a minute. And the appendix is the first exposure and is the connection that the first connection Tolkien gives to the readers into where that depth comes from. Because where that depth comes from, spoiler alert, is his Legendarium. There's a lot of mechanical ways in which that functions, but the bottom line, the short answer is that it comes from the fact that there's this enormous Legendarium, all this material that exists and predates the Lord of the Rings. The appendix is a bridge that goes back to the Silmarillion and connects these two and shows the connective tissue. Because the connective tissue is already there. The Lord of the Rings and the Legendarium are deeply, deeply connected. So maybe saying it's a bridge is not actually all that accurate. What it is it's like a model of the bridge. It takes the curtain back and shows the reader how these things are connected. What's weird about the whole thing is that nobody knew they were connected when it first came out. When The Lord of the Rings came out, nobody had ever heard of the Silmarillion. Nobody knew what the First Age was. So it must have been a tremendously unusual experience to read the appendices for the first time without having any idea what was going on with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think as you read The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit as well, there are these sort of hints at a larger world from, you know, the ruins that they happen upon and the weapons that are, you know, used and reforged. There's all these sort of like little Easter eggs just kind of indicating that there's more under the surface. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Tolkien originally wanted The Lord of the Rings to come out as one book, right? One volume.
Yeah, one big skull crusher.
So that would have been really interesting, because I feel like you have to get through the Fellowship of the Ring, the Two Towers. You know, there's like years in between those, I assume. That's, you know, not, that's a somewhat of a slow burn. And then all of a sudden at the end of Return of the King, finally all these questions are asked. I wonder if it would have been a different reading experience had they had all three at one time.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know. I think it's, for us reading it now, we can just sort of plow through all three. But I would have been interested. I wonder if it would have changed how people received the material originally if they'd gotten all three at once.
Possibly. And then the Silmarillion didn't come out for much longer. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. The Silmarillion didn't come out until 1977.
Nice.
Was the first published date of the Silmarillion, which was after Tolkien's death. And it was published by 4 years after Tolkien died. And it was published by his son, Christopher, with the help of a British author, Guy Gavriel Key, who's written a bunch of fantasy and is actually really, a really interesting author. There's a really, it's not important. There's a really interesting interview with him about how he contributed to the writing of the Silmarillion.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. It had been Tolkien's original intention, actually, to publish the Silmarillion after The Hobbit, because that's what he really wanted to publish.
Wow.
Which was a joke, because it wasn't remotely ready to be published.
Now, why is that?
It was a mess. The Silmarillion was in a really crazy condition. It was in 40 drafts of everything, and it was just not ready. It was not remotely publishable. There's no real narrative to The Silmarillion. I mean, even if you go back and even if you look at The Silmarillion as it was published in 77, it doesn't really have a single connected narrative. It's like a bunch of interconnected tales. And it was even less so at that point in his life.
Wow.
So there was no way we were going to publish it in that condition. There's just no way. So they went, obviously, Alan and Unwin were just like, yeah, no, we want hobbits. So he went back and he wrote Lord of the Rings. And as a result, because he had all this material laying there, that's where you get the Lord of the Rings.
Wow, but the Silmarillion was in, was at the point where it could be finished by Christopher and other people. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it was definitely the way Tolkien wrote. He rewrote and revised and rebuilt. And so there were dozens of drafts of some things and tons of versions. I think there's like, I don't know, like 7 versions of the Gondolin story. And there's like 5 different, not just like drafts, but like wholly different versions of Beren and Luthien.
Whoa.
Like there's the first one is in prose, and then there's a straight up poem, and then another one that's like an alliterative verse.
And there's got to be one that's just a big limerick, and there's got to be one where Beren has a high top fade, and there's got to be one set at the mall, right? Because come on.
Honestly, I'd read that.
Me too. Somebody please write that.
There's probably some Tolkien fan fiction out there that resets Beren and as an 80s mall story. I'd read that fan fiction.
Ugh, gag me with a spoon.
But yeah, that's part of what made his creative process so interesting, is that he revised and rewrote his story so much, and it made Christopher's job really hard. But it also created this enormous body of material. And transitions nicely into the first thing I wanted to talk about with this piece, which is this creation of the impression of depth. I found a really interesting paper on this subject in Tolkien Studies 11. Michael D.C. Drought, Namiko Hitotsubashi, and Rachel Scavera. If I mispronounced any of your names, if you ever listen to this podcast, which is not a huge thing I'm worried about, but you never know.
They might. You never know. You guys wrote, just add us on Twitter and let us know.
Yeah, there you go. They wrote a fantastic paper in Tolkien Studies about how the very specific ways in which Tolkien uses his existing legendarium material to generate this impression of depth. And they cite four specific factors.
Ooh.
The vast size and intricate detail of his background material. The ways he refers to this background material through seemingly casual and incomplete allusions. The logical gaps and apparent inconsistencies in his stories. And then lastly, the variations in style within the given texts.
Whoa, that's awesome.
Yeah, and then they go deep in this stuff. Like, they don't just talk about how those four things happen. They even go into talking about the... They get very, very detailed. Going down into talking about how all of the various versions of the tale, the legendary material are worked in, and they get very specific. It's not really germane to the discussion we're having here, but it's a super exciting paper. And if you're interested in it, fortunately, it's not publicly available. It's in Tolkien Studies 11, which you can buy online. You can buy it's publicly available as much as you can buy it. You can buy the journal on the website. But it's not like posted online somewhere. You can download it for free.
Well, maybe
there is an excerpt that you can find that I will post a link to.
Yeah, maybe like on a future episode, we can go back and look at their arguments in more depth because it sounds absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting paper. It's way more technical than I thought it was going to get. I was reading the first part of it and I was like, this is super interesting. And then it gets down into like, you start getting into things like subtle heterogeneity in the prose style. And I'm just like,
uh-oh.
What?
You lost me.
Well,
I get it. It's
very
a lot.
Technical, very fast. And I love stuff like that. I love that Tolkien Studies has become that kind of a complex and deep field. I think it's really exciting. But yeah, that's one of the things that is really, I think, interesting about the appendices is Lord of the Rings has this enormous depth. And then you get to the end of it, you flip to the appendices and you get just suddenly bopped in the nose with this reveal of all this material that you've been seeing hints and peaks and references. You just get this crazy info dump at the end where it's dropping names, Morgoth and Arendel and all these people and events and the War of Wrath and blah, 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 and all this stuff. You got no context for, and it must have been such a weird thing to read at the time.
Yeah, because a lot of the stuff that it references was kind of only mentioned like tangentially in the story itself. So you'd be like, there's like a mention of like the dude who built Dargonath, right? And you're so like in the story, you're like, oh, cool, big sculptures, that's neat. And then I've already forgotten what that's called by the time I get to the appendices, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it gives you the option to go back and kind of learn more, and it kind of whets your appetite.
Yeah, exactly. So one thing that's also really interesting before we move on from the depth thing, one thing I thought that was really cool with this is how much of it was Tolkien. It's kind of an open question how intentional a lot of this was for Tolkien. He definitely intended there to be a sense of mystery to this stuff. Like he really wanted there to be a sense of mystery and a sense of unrevealedness. As we talked about last week, Tolkien was very aware of how fairy stories work. There's a couple of letters where he talks about this, of his own letters that are published, where he talks about wanting to maintain that sense of mystery beyond the borders. But it's also an open question as to whether he understood exactly what he was doing. A lot of it, I think he was just using what he had available to him and was just writing in the style that he liked. I don't get the impression that he was being calculating when he used a lot of this stuff, if you know what I mean.
You don't think so? You don't think it was all planned out?
No, I don't think he sat down and said, if I use a reference to Numenor here, and then if I, you know, name drop this sword over here, it'll feel really good. Like, I think he just was like,
yeah,
you know, I think he just threw it in because he had it, you know, because he knew that stuff off the top of his head and he thought it worked. Like,
man, so like kind of like 90s superstar Sarah McLachlan, he was sort of building a mystery, but maybe somewhat unintentionally.
Yeah, in a sense, I think, so the paper makes an interesting point, the way it talks about Beowulf, a favorite of Tolkien's. And Tolkien was writing a story within a culture, and he was making cultural references. The weird thing about it is that he's just the only one who was a part of that culture at the time.
A culture of one.
Yeah, and I think that's a really accurate way of putting it. He was just so deep in it, I just don't think it really occurred to him. I don't think he was doing it to be intentionally obfuscatory. I think he just was writing a story within this world, and that's what he was doing, you know? Like, he was telling the story as best as he knew how, and the fact that it generated this amazing depth was kind of a spectacularly great coincidence. So.
Wow.
Let's talk really briefly about how the appendix got written. I'm not going to spend a ton of time on this, but apparently it was a vexing process for Tolkien. In History of Middle-earth, Volume 12, Peoples of Middle-earth, Christopher Tolkien writes a little bit about the process, and apparently he went over the material that would eventually become the appendices several times, and it started out very long and then got very short and then got very long and got very short. And I think that's kind of, I suspect that's why it ends up looking like it does, because he's got this, he knows what information he's trying to get across, or he's got an idea about what he's trying to say here. I think he's trying to, at least in the Numenorean Kings section, it seems clear to me what he's trying to do. I'm a little less clear on the second two sections, the Houses of Errol and the Durin's Folk. I'm a little less clear on what exactly, specifically, he's trying to do. But on the Numenorean Kings section, it seems to me like he's really specifically trying to say, here's how Aragorn happened.
Yeah.
Here is the straight line to Aragorn. And so In the various drafts he was doing, starts out with, here's the encyclopedic history of how this happened. And then he narrows it down and gets down to, like, you know, so-and-so begat so-and-so begat so-and-so kind of thing. And then he expands it out again. And he's struggling with how best to format that knowledge and that information. And eventually he ends up with this 20-page-ish material thing.
Yeah. That really reads like one of, like, you know, the chronicles of the kings of old of England. It has the same kind of, because it's kind of dry, right? But that's, again, that also lends to the realness feeling of it, because sometimes that genealogical history is pretty darn dry. It hints at more, but on the surface it's like, oh, snooze fest.
Yeah, it's very much got his, it's got his sort of record-keeping voice, I think, is how I kind of think of it sometimes. He's got a specific voice he uses when he's chronicling information versus storytelling.
Yeah.
His professorial voice, maybe, is a better way of putting it, which definitely sounds like a professor voice.
Sure. And that would have been pretty natural for him as a, you know, as a longtime professor.
Yeah, exactly. Apparently, though, he was a fantastic professor. I've read a couple of biographies that said he was very animated and a very well-liked professor.
Aw, that's Oxford. Cool.
Let's dig into the meat of it. What I specifically want to do is I want to look at this and talk about the ways in which this illuminates the Lord of the Rings connection back to the Silmarillion.
Cool. And just, like, for full disclosure, I have read the Lord of the Rings and the appendices, but I have not read the Silmarillion. Okay, I know what they are, but that's where it stops. So
that's all right.
You can guide us down the elven path. That would be great. Or whatever.
All right. That makes sense. I think that's a good way to look at it. I think because a lot of people, I think, approached the appendices with no real context for what a lot of this gibberish meant, I think that's not unuseful to have that perspective. So
yeah, see, I did it on purpose. I wasn't just lazy. It was intentional, damn it.
So let's dive in here. The first section is my favorite in the entire appendices.
Because it's ridiculous.
It really is. It really, really is. Well, the second section. The first section is the concerning the sources section, which I always skip over because I want to get to the Numenorean King section.
Yeah.
But the concerning sources section, which is basically like, Gimli told them this in Durin's folk, and like, and this is one of my favorite things. Tolkien loved framing devices. He loved framing devices.
Oh, sure.
Everything he wrote in Middle-earth had a reasonable path for how we could be reading it, or no, that's not a good way of putting it.
Well, maybe what you're trying to say is another way of making it feel real is that we know the source. We're friends with Gimli. We just went on this giant long thing with him. So if he's telling me the story of Durin's folk, I'm going to super listen, because if it's important to him, it's important to me.
Yeah, I definitely think he felt that way. Every single thing we read, every book that we are reading, he doesn't just want it to be, oh, I wrote a book. He wants that book you're reading to be a book in the world that you're reading about. So The Hobbit and The Lord of the Ring is the Red Book of Westmark. And The Silmarillion is, in its original conception, Christopher Tolkien's greatest regret, reportedly, with The Silmarillion, is that he stripped this out in the draft that got published. Was there was a framing device where it was a translation of a series of tales that was found by, like, 14th century mariners who recorded it after sailing to the west all the way to Valinor and being told these tales by elves.
Whoa, I love that. That works with On Fairy stories too, and the fact that a lot of those start as an oral tradition that are eventually written down.
Yeah. Everything he wrote, he wanted to have a connection inside the material. He even used that same system to explain multiple drafts or multiple versions. So like the first version of The Hobbit, the original published version of The Hobbit before he connected it to The Lord of the Rings, is the version of Bilbo's story that he tells the dwarves. And then when Gandalf beats him up and gets the real story of what happened with the ring and the riddles in the dark, that's the second edition of The Hobbit. The one that's got the actual, like, the real version of events, that's the version that he tells Gandalf.
That's so great.
Yeah, and that's classic Tolkien. So I like that he gives these sources and he says, oh, well, the bit about Durin's folk, this is from Gimli, and the bit about the Numenorean kings and stuff, this is all from Bilbo and his notes when he was in blah, blah, blah. Like, it's very Tolkien to do that and to want to establish that this information you're about to read has an in-universe source where this could have come from. It's very Tolkien.
Yeah, it's very compelling, too, as the reader. Just makes the world that much more real.
Yeah, absolutely. So this bonkers introduction to the Numenor section, which is like 5, 6 or 7 paragraphs of the most dense info dump of the first age I've ever seen. The whole point of which is to set up how Elrond and Elros come to be, the half-elven. This whole thing, all the way down to like the first like 6, 7 paragraphs here, what he's getting at here is how does Numenor come to be? And because Numenor is founded by Elrond's brother, he's got to tell how the half-elven come to be. And the half-elven are intricately connected to, like, every important thing that happened in the War of Wrath. And with all the Silmarils, you got to tell all that. So it ends up being this bonkers summary of these crazy events just to tell how Numenor came to be. Not just, Numenor's a pretty big deal.
I mean, it's kind of a big deal.
Kind of a big deal. But you get this, really, it's just... I'm always blown away every time I read it by just how much he packs in and how much territory he covers in so little space.
Oh, yeah. Because, like, how many years is the first age? Is it, like, 1,000 years? I mean,
no,
yeah,
it's like tens
see?
Of thousands.
So there's a lot that's happening.
Covers a lot of territory there. Yeah. Anyway, we get a large amount of the Silmarillion stuff covered there, but we don't really connect to any of it. He talks about it, but
where we see the first evidence of actual connective tissue between the Lord of the Rings and this stuff is Eärendil. Up until that name, a lot of the stuff that you see going on in this paragraph is kind of gobbledygook.
Kind of.
If you hadn't, I mean, you haven't read the Silmarillion, so I would imagine that most of this stuff for you didn't look like anything the first time.
Yeah, a lot of it was like, well, clearly he's hinting at more. And, you know, I didn't realize that I was reading the cliff notes of the Silmarillion. That's good to know. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. Eärendil is a super important figure. And even though he doesn't show up that much in the Silmarillion, he's a really important figure in the Silmarillion because of he has a super clutch, pivotal role in ending the War of Wrath. And because of his heritage.
Sure.
Because of who his parents were and because of who his children were. And this is where you see the first real... This is the first major connection between the Silmarillion and the Lord of the Rings that this piece reveals. And that's that this epic hero of the War of Wrath is Elrond's father.
Bwah, 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 Aragorn.
And I think, yeah, right? And then that's, I wonder, that must have been such a cool reveal to someone who reading this for the first time and didn't know any of this
absolutely.
Stuff.
And then you would think, wow, I get why Elrond was so mad at Isildur. God damn it. For fuck's sake,
yeah,
guys.
Yeah. I just went through this with one Dark Lord.
Yeah, or, my daddy. You know. We're Todd for you people, and then just nothing from you.
That's one thing that is really interesting later on in this piece, is the repeated nonsense that Sauron gets up to.
Ugh, that fucking guy.
you see that his pattern repeats. We'll see that in a second. We'll get down to that in a little bit here. So you've got Elrond now, and Elrond comes into the story, and we start to see in the Half-Elven, we see Elrond and Elros. And this is where this piece, this is, I think, one of the most important things this piece is trying to do is talk about what the deal with the Half-Elven is. And we're not going to get into the choice too much here. But the short version is the choice is the Half-Elven can be either elves or men. And the elves, Elrond's children, get the choice as well. They have the choice to either remain in Middle-earth and become mortal, or to go with him back to Valinor. Whereas all of Elros' children become mortal. And that's basically how the choice works. And we'll get into that when we talk about Aragorn next episode.
I mean,
because there's a lot
absolutely.
To unpack there.
I mean, you know, you know how I feel about the choice. I just don't think the choice was that fair for Elros's kids. You know, how come my cousins get to decide, but I don't? That's crap.
That's a very latter day Numenorean opinion.
Oh my god. Well, we'll get into that, I'm sure, at some point.
Yeah. It gets into a better explanation of it in some various sources. Tolkien certainly didn't choose to set the system up like that, unconsidered. I think the basic explanation for why it works that way is, yeah, the short version is basically just that the children of Elrond have the choice to go with him and remain, but if they stayed in the world, they couldn't stay immortal. The world doesn't let them be immortal because of the way the world is marred. So it's not that they got screwed or anything like that. They did get screwed.
Wait a minute.
It's just that the world wasn't going to let them stay immortal and in Middle-earth. So they could stay immortal, but they'd have to go to Valinor. If they wanted to be in Middle-earth, though, they had to become mortal. So it's not like they got double choices or anything like that. It was just that they only got to keep their immortality if they went to Valinor. And then it gets into the origins of Numenor. And it talks about the geography of Numenor, because
Tolkien loves nothing so much as a geography.
Oh my God, lesson. Yes, he does.
I really look forward to our episode entirely about of Beleriand, where we review all the rivers and valleys and hills of Beleriand for 90 minutes.
No. Oh, no. I bought that Atlas of Middle Earth book, which is filled with all kinds of fantastic drawings of somebody who did a thing, tried to figure it all out.
Yeah. It's a beautiful book, but it's a lot less exciting as in The Silmarillion.
Oh.
Or as an audiobook. I have the audiobook of The Silmarillion, and believe me, there's no amount of British accent that makes somebody reciting the names of this river flowed into this river.
Oh, no.
And then to the sea is... That doesn't make compelling... compelling.
I mean, at least throw in an alluvial plain every now and then, you know? Let's break it up. Do a plateau or something, or, you know, like a weird tributary. God damn it.
It's a famously back-breaking chapter for people's first read through The Silmarillion.
Oh, no. Oh, good. Well, we'll do the funsy Cliff Notes version, right? Yeah. She said.
We'll see.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so we get into the kings of Numenor after we get the brief geography lesson. And we don't really care about that so much. I mean, we do. The Numenorean kings have cool names, and there's some cool stuff in there. There's lots of interesting little tidbits of history. One thing I will note as you look through these rules, we look through these names, I will say this is kind of the first time we've run across Quenya in the podcast, so I will say a quick thing about pronouncing Quenya. In some of these names, you'll see some interesting diacritical marks, accent marks, and what looks like umlauts, the double dots. The accent mark means a long vowel, and the umlaut means, hey, don't skip me, actually say the vowel.
Oh, like Latin.
Yeah, exactly. I'll put a link to some Quenya pronunciation notes in the show notes, but we'll cover the Elven languages much more thoroughly later on in the later episode. But just when you're reading these Quenya names, all the first block of the Numenorean kings and queens names are in Quenya. So as you're reading them, if you're curious about how to pronounce them properly, there'll be some notes for you to take a look at. So.
Do you have like a favorite Numenorean monarch?
Good question.
Ooh. I put you on the spot.
I think it's probably Tar-An-Khalime.
That was a chick, right?
The first queen. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Totally.
Because she's pretty badass.
Fuck yeah.
Her dad didn't want the crown to pass to his nephew, who was apparently kind of a dumbass. So he changed the rules from primogeniture to whatever the non-patriarchal version of that is, so that it could pass to the first child, not the first son. But there was still a law on the books that said... you had to be married in order to remain the monarch. So she accepted a marriage, even though she didn't want one. Basically, she put up with a phenomenal amount of bullshit from the patriarchal culture that had surrounded her. But she was a much loved queen, apparently, and dealt with a lot of nonsense in order to be queen. But was a very good one, and her son was apparently a good king, and yeah, I just think she's got a good story.
That's cool. Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like I thought I read somewhere where that was like the first time that we see that happening, that like that hadn't, yeah, of a female monarch, you know. I don't know if that's right, so don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure that's a thing
in Tolkien's thing. Yeah, that might be one of the first human female monarchs in Tolkien's stuff. Yeah.
Cool.
Well, chronologic? No, that's not true.
Jeez.
You've got one of the houses of the Edain, which is the human tribes that allied with the elves during the War of Wrath, had a female chieftain. They didn't really have kings per se. I mean, they kind of did, but one of them was the Haladin, but they later renamed themselves the House of Haleth because they kind of got whooped by a bunch of orcs, and the person who stepped up was the chieftain, was Haleth, the chieftain's daughter, and she was a notorious hard ass, just the most terrifying and an incredible warrior. Took no shit from anybody. One of the sons, Caranthir, I think his name was. One of the sons of Feanor offered her a fiefdom, like, hey, you swear fealty to me and you can live on my land. And she was like, fuck off. And she led her people into other lands and was like, hey, I'm going to take this land and I'm going to protect it. And he's like, all right. and ended up being friends with, I can't remember where she ended up. I don't have the notes right in front of me exactly. Sure. Haleth was awesome. But that was many, many years before Tar-Ankalime. But I think she might have been the first, like, straight up queen, human queen that we see. But Haleth definitely predated her in terms of being like a leader of men, so to speak.
Nice.
Anyway,
back on track.
Yeah, that was a fun digression, but we're gonna skip ahead a little bit here through this stuff here because we get a brief history of how things start to go sour in Numenor, because I want to skip ahead to our friend Sauron, who shows up on scene. The Numenoreans get real big for their britches, and they head over to Middle-earth, and they find Sauron has been causing trouble, and they decide they're gonna whoop him up. They yep. head over there, and they've been conquering and setting up shop all over Middle-earth. And when they discover that Sauron's been trying to set up his own little empire, they literally just stomp him to the curb. Like, they just whoop him completely and drag him back to Numenor in chains.
Oh, now, wait a minute. I don't know. I feel like in the appendix it says that he was like, well, okay, I'll go with you, sure. I guess all my little army guys ran away because they're the worst. But I feel like, I mean, was it like a struggle or did he, was he like, I've got an idea?
Definitely. I mean, the Numenoreans definitely kicked the crap out of his army. Like the reason why he was forced to do this specific plan, like to do it this way, was the Numenoreans marched up into Middle-earth, and his army, his servants and his orcs and his armies were just like, peace, and just flat out deserted him. they just saw that there was no possible winning. So they fled him, and that's when he decided to take another route with this one.
Sure.
He ends up becoming does this whole temptation and corruption methodology. And this is a part I want to focus on a little bit, because I think it's real interesting that you see right from his first real appearance in, he has a couple of real out of character appearances in the Silmarillion, not out of character, but he shows up in the Silmarillion, but he's not really doing his own specific thing in the Silmarillion. But he's just kind of a flunky in the Silmarillion. Let me put it this way. This is where you can see Tolkien has a really fully developed Sauron's character and methodology. and has now gone back and thought about how he's going to, how he used it in the past. And when we see him in the previously in the Silmarillion, he's flying around like a vampire bat guy. Like, he's doing all kinds of weird stuff.
And he's doing flips and shit.
Yeah. So here he worms his way into the confidences of Air Farazon.
Oh, that fucking guy.
Yeah, for real. Not a notoriously good dude.
No.
Old, afraid of death. He's extremely vulnerable to Sauron's whispers. And he decides he's just going to listen to this evil spirit that they just decided to whoop. This summary is very brief and leaves out some of the fun facts, like the fact that he talked the Numenoreans into setting up a temple to Morgoth. They don't mention that.
What? Yeah. That's not in the appendix. That's got to be in the Silmarillion. What? Yeah. Oh, no.
That's in the Akalabeth, which is a part of the Silmarillion where they talk about Numenor.
Well, they're going to have egg on their face. That's not good. Well,
it gets better.
No.
They were also eating people.
What? What? Whoa. Hold on. Hold on now.
They were making human sacrifices, and it's sort of implied in the text that there may have been some cannibalism going on.
Oh no, there was like a giant Numenorean buffet filled with people that got sacrificed. Oh yeah. No. I don't want to go to this island.
Yeah, they were like burning people alive and...
Oh god!
There's some sort of suggestions that Ar-Pharazôn might have been doing some like... cannibalistic rituals or something like that to try and preserve his life or in worship of Morgoth, stuff like that. But
oh jeez,
basically
just a real stand-up guy.
Basically Sauron just corrupts Air Farazon all the way down, and his ultimate corruption is to get him to break the ban, which is that they can't sail. I just gestured west.
That's great on a podcast.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, he gets them to sail west towards Valinor.
Because that was like the one thing where they were like, we'll give you this island, kings of Numenor. It's going to be great. But if you come west, we're going to be real pissed at you.
Yeah. And
shit.
Sure enough, that's exactly what they do. They sail west. And this
make
is
make a man burger, go for a sail. It's fine. Everything's great.
Yeah. This is where we get the origins of Gondor and Anor and the Dunedain, the people of Numenor who are faithful to the traditional Numenorean ways, flee Numenor before the island explodes or sinks or whatever. And those are the people that end up founding Gondor and Anor. And that's Aragorn's line.
That's so cool. They were like, bye.
Yeah, they get out of there. And that's Elendil and Isildur. And Elendil and his son, Isildur, who gets up to some trouble.
Oh, yeah, he does. Just ask Elrond. God damn it.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like Isildur has to be, or not Isildur, Elrond has to be like, my fucking brother.
Like, oh, my God, giant eye roll. Oh, yeah. That fucking guy.
Like, he has to be a little disappointed with his brother's kids.
Oh, no. It's like they'll still will invite them to the holiday kind of meal thing, but they're definitely not going to sit with them. They're definitely going to have to sit at the kids' table.
Yeah, exactly. So one cool callback to The Lord of the Rings in this is that Sauron gets wrecked with Numenor. He's still on Numenor when the island gets trashed. And so there's some hope that he is killed, but that's not how it works.
Nope. He's like, I'm still here. Fuck you guys.
Yeah. And this is one of my favorite parts here. This is what I was referring to a little earlier, is tell me if this sounds familiar.
Mm-hmm.
You think Sauron was destroyed a while ago, so everybody's kind of let their guard down. But then he sneaks back in and rebuilds his empire, and then you have to get the troops together and raise an army to put him down.
Right.
Like, it's the
wait a minute.
It's the same thing. Like,
hold on a second. I know what that is. I think I've read a couple books about that.
Yeah, he kind of pulls the same maneuver as he does after this exact war. After this happens, he does basically the exact same thing again an entire age later. After he's defeated, he just tries to sneak right back into Gondor and start over again.
I mean, it's like, get some new material, man. Come on.
Well, what's interesting? Yeah, what's really interesting about that is it's not at all like him. If you go back and look at what he does in the Silmarillion and what he does on Numenor, repeating himself is not at all. It's not like him. He's an improviser and a planner. He doesn't. I don't know. It's interesting to me that he repeats this mistake.
If he was really a planner, he would have had a boat ready or a damn inflatable raft when Nor went down. Okay, that's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, I always did wonder about that.
Damn,
why he
floaty
didn't get on
rings.
The boat.
Come on,
like,
man.
He had to have known that. Like, he knew what was going to. I mean, maybe he didn't know. Maybe he really thought they'd get away with it. But I don't know. I wondered what he thought he was going to get. What he thought was going to happen? Just hanging out on Numenor. He lost his body. Like.
I know.
He was never able to take a physical form again after.
Right.
After
I know.
Numenor. Why didn't he just get on a boat?
Right. Just get on the fucking boat. One minute you're at a swim up bar having a nice milkshake made of sacrificed man parts. And then the next minute your whole island is going down in flames. But you were come on. You could have foreseen that, buddy. Jeez Louise. Yeah. Get a jet ski, right? Am I right?
I don't know. Like, I wonder what he was thinking there.
Oh my god, now all I can picture is Sauron wearing a tankini at a swim-up bar. I'm so happy. He's like, I'll have a Mai Tai. or no, he's like, I'll have a rum cannonball. And there's some king like, what? Wait, what?
I had a blank moment there where I was trying to imagine what drink Sauron orders.
Oh yeah, like something ridiculous, like... A Bloody Mary? No? Anyone?
No? I don't know. Okay, anyway. Yeah.
Guys, do a hashtag Sauron's favorite drink and let us know what you guys think Sauron would order at a swim-up bar on Numenor.
Yes, that is exactly what we should do. Crowdsource this.
We want to hear from you.
So that gets us all the way to the end of the end of Numenor and the end of the Second Age. The appendices then move into a deeply detailed breakdown of Gondor and Arnor's rise and fall. And this stuff's less relevant to our sort of thesis here. It's really interesting, cool stuff, but it's really sort of just background material. We'll get into a lot of this stuff next episode when we talk about Aragorn. So we're not going to touch on it here.
Sure.
Last thing I want to talk about this is why I think this is a useful thing to talk about now in our second episode. I think this is a great transition. Last episode we talked about On Fairy Stories. We talked about Tolkien's thesis statement. And I think the appendices are really a great transition from you've read The Lord of the Rings, or maybe you're a little new, to the wider, weirder world of stuff we're going to get into. The appendices are just like all those people that got to the end of The Return of the King and opened it up, and you start seeing some of the weird stuff under the surface there. That's exactly what we want to use these appendices to do, is to start peeling back some of the layers on this stuff. And next episode, when we talk about Aragorn and Arwen, we're going to use Aragorn as an avenue to dig deeper into the choice and half-elves and some of the cooler, weirder spiritual nonsense that goes on. And we'll get a little more into witch kings and things like that, because there's some cool stuff about that.
Witch King? The Witch King! Meat mop.
I really like the appendices because they are a bridge out of the Lord of the Rings into this wider world. And especially now, maybe at the time when it was published, the appendices would have been a frustrating and confusing thing. But now, as a reader, you get to the end of The Return of the King and you crack open that appendix and you read that stuff, and that can be your hook into well, I guess I got to go read the Silmarillion. And you go read the Silmarillion and you get hooked into this wider world of stuff that's out there for you to dig into that Tolkien wrote. There's so much more out there. I read The Lord of the Rings for the first time. I have no recollection of the first time I read The Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
I read it very, very young and I don't really remember it. And then I read The Silmarillion. And that's like the first thing I remember of Tolkien really reading. Like that's the first thing I remember reading. Then I saw the movies. Then I went back and read the books. So for me, The Silmarillion is like the first context I have for Tolkien. Even though I knew the events of The Lord of the Rings, like The Silmarillion is like where my brain lives. And so I kind of do it backwards. But I think it's exciting for people to get into The Silmarillion and the histories and read all the wide, weird world that's out there for them. There's so much cool stuff that doesn't get read because of some of the weird language in the Silmarillion.
The overabundance of rivers.
The overabundance of rivers, yes. How hilarious. Yeah, there's just a lot out there. And the appendices are, I think, how a lot of people are first going to be exposed to it. Hopefully people will get interested in it about what else is out there and keep listening.
Absolutely. And it's really exciting to be, at least for me, someone who hasn't read The Silmarillion, to kind of be going on this journey with you as a guide and then also with our listeners as sort of partners in this. So I'm really excited to take another kind of wade into Tolkien's beautiful, insane mind.
Yeah, there's a lot to see. There's a lot of fun stuff coming. After the Aragorn and Arwen episode, we're really going to dive in with 2 feet and we're going to start hitting, I think, the Silmarillion. I think we're going to do a couple Silmarillion episodes. And then after that, who knows? We'll see what happens.
Awesome. The road may go ever on, but this episode is over. Join us next episode, where we continue our discussion of Appendix A of The Lord of the Rings and talk about everybody's favorite it couple, Aragorn and Arwen. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes, as it helps increase our visibility. You can find the show on Twitter at @Athrabeth_cast. Jude can be found at @AramiticJude, and I can be found at The North Four. Title music is Lord of the Devil Rings by Q Fox. Thanks for listening.